With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we have this week's Almond Update, featuring a preview of the upcoming Almond Conference. And we'll hear about legislation to improve specialty crop exports. But our top story today, the USDA has resumed hearings on federal milk marketing orders. Chad Smith has more on the resumption after the long break.
Hearings to modernize federal milk marketing orders have resumed with a lot of work ahead. Roger Cryan, chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation, talks about where the hearings are at in the schedule.
What's happening right now is USDA's resumed the hearing that broke in mid-October that went on for 8 weeks before that. There's a hope to get that done in these 2 weeks. Right now, the topic is class one and class two differentials, and there's a long set of witnesses to go over a lot of details for National Milk's proposal. And I expect another long set of witnesses to go over the Milk Innovation Group's proposal.
Cryan says there is still one big topic left to cover, price differentials.
Well, the big thing we're looking forward to is presenting on our proposal to raise the Class 2 differential, which right now is 70 cents per hundredweight, and we are proposing to raise that to $1.56 per hundredweight. And I look forward to USDA recognizing that the logic of their decision from order reform means that they really should be increasing the Class 2 price for the benefit of farmers.
He says there's still a long way to go in the FMMO reform process.
If the hearing doesn't wrap up by the end of next week, which it probably won't, they're almost certain to pick it up again in January, which is, of course, another 2 months delay in moving things forward. Every additional month it takes to finish the hearing is another month that's going to delay the eventual implementation of this thing. If everything moves really swiftly after a January completion, none of these things are likely to take effect until at least the beginning of 2025. So it's a long process.
Learn more at fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
Beef cattle herd contraction is still going on. Gary Crawford has more in this report.
Well, I think it's fairly consistent with what everybody was expecting.
That's USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagham talking about USDA's most recent report on cattle feedlot activity and inventories. And here are some of the key numbers from that report.
The number of cattle placed on feed during October was just under 2.2 million head, which was about 4% above a year ago. Feedlots marketed just under 1.8 million head during October, which was 3% below a year ago. But there was an extra slaughter day during October, so if you adjust that extra day, we were actually 7% below a year ago. The number of cattle on feed on November 1st was about 11.9 million head, which was 2% above a year ago.
So placements during October were quite a bit higher than for October a year ago. A couple of factors at work there.
We have continued dryness in the southern plains, and that manifests itself in heavy placements in those states.
Plus, there are the financial incentives to place cattle in feedlots.
Overall, we're still looking at relatively high prices, just factoring in the continuing declines in supplies of cattle from lower inventories.
And yes, even though there will be a surge of cattle ready for slaughter next summer, basically the beef cattle herd is still shrinking. It's just not showing up in lower feedlot placements or inventories as yet. It's behind the scenes.
I think that's probably a very good characterization. I mean, we are still looking at relatively high cow slaughter. We're looking at probably digging fairly deeply into the pool of animals which are still outside feedlots.
So once again,
everything is sort of pointing towards the fact that we are looking to continue contraction in the inventory.
Higher cow slaughter and higher placements now, it just means that even further down the line, it's going to continue to tighten up supplies.
A new voice there, it's USDA's Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski. He says with that contraction in the herd, we are for 2024 looking at
really very historically high steer prices.
Steer prices this year are averaging over $177 a hundredweight.
For next year, we think that's going to continue to increase up by about $7.45 per hundredweight.
To almost $185, or an increase of about 4%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And we'll have more from the livestock sector coming up. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, a group of southern states ruled against a summer biofuel decision by the Biden administration. David Geiger has details.
A court says this summer's biofuel exemption denials were not legal.
Wouldn't necessarily say it was expected, but we were worried about it.
That's Iowa Renewable Fuels Association Executive Director Monty Shaw. He says the previous administration allowed exemptions, but then this last summer,
when the Biden administration came in, they basically looked at it and said, yeah, none of these are justified, and denied them.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals disagrees with that action, claiming it overlooked economic burdens. A coalition representing farmers and ethanol producers responded to the judgment, saying the RFS does not impose an economic burden on refiners. Shaw claims the facts are on their side, including research from the American Petroleum Institute.
Almost all the economists agree that the cost of compliance with the renewable fuel standard for a refiner, large or small, is passed along in their products, and so it really doesn't hit their bottom line.
Shaw says ultimately this is just one court decision.
But in other regions, they have sided with the Biden EPA. So I think what we're going to see next is all this is going to get kicked upstairs to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Shaw says it is a setback and they are unsure how it will play out, but he's hopeful the D.C. court will adjudicate.
Because you don't want different rules for different refineries. I mean, I think we can all agree that's not fair. We need to get an answer to this. We think the answer is that these refiner exemptions are not justified under the law and that they should be denied based on all the evidence that's out there.
Reporting from Des Moines, Iowa, I'm David Geiger.
A recent initiative by National Farmers Union promotes fairness for farmers, an effort to fight what NFU calls the monopoly crisis in American agriculture. Mike Strands, National Farmers Union Vice President of Advocacy, explains.
It's all about competition and addressing monopolies in agriculture, in our rural communities, and in the economy in general. We know that when just a few companies control most of a market, it's bad news for the farmers and the consumers and everybody else in that space. So we've been raising those messages of how monopolies harm our bottom line as farmers and ranchers and our communities. We've gotten some uptake on that as well, as far as emphasizing competition in Congress and in the administration. We've seen a whole flurry of bills addressing issues in the cattle markets, for instance, on right to repair, on choices in other parts of the economy as well. Plus, we've seen the Biden administration put forward some very important rules on the Packers and Stockyards Act.
Strand says their efforts are helping to spur competition-focused items in the Farm Bill.
So a couple things are on the Meat and Poultry Special Investigator Act, for instance. This is a bill that would put further emphasis and resources into how USDA would uphold the Packers and Stockyards Act and other competition rules and laws in the meat sector. Some other competition bills we've seen action on are on right to repair. We've seen progress on state levels, but there's also a bill at the federal level that recently was introduced by some Agriculture Committee members. So those are a couple examples where we're seeing some push already on the competition title.
In other news, even with meteorological winter set to begin Friday, there have been signs of winter weather in parts of the country throughout the Thanksgiving holiday period. Rod Bain has more.
Sub-zero temperatures early in the week in the upper Midwest. An initial freeze in California's Central Valley. Among the indications, winter is approaching. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says the wintry activity even made an appearance on Thanksgiving Day.
Most significant band of snow stretched across parts of the Central Plains and then into the lower Midwest and into the Great Lakes region. Some of that snow is still on the ground. And we saw that event peaking back just right after Thanksgiving and the weekend after. It did cause some travel disruptions, both by automobile and airplane.
Notable snow accumulations were reported during the holiday weekend in the Central Plains.
Snow coverage is still not all that great across the country. We are seeing, at this time, a little less than one quarter of the country covered by snow.
Fell mostly in western mountain ranges and a stretch from the plains to the northeast. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, China's General Administration of Customs recently approved 18 U.S. beef establishments and 12 U.S. pork establishments for export to China. According to a story from John Harith, these are the first new U.S. plants cleared for export to China in about 10 months.
U.S. beef and pork exports to China received a boost recently with new plant approvals that were a long time coming. Aaron Bohr, U.S. Meat Export Federation Vice President for Economic Analysis, has more details.
The Phase One agreement has many benefits for U.S. agriculture, but particularly related to plant approvals. Since the 2020 implementation of the Phase One agreement, China has further rolled out plant and establishment registration processes that are fairly complex. And fortunately for U.S. beef and pork, Phase One takes precedent. USDA Food Safety Inspection Service plant approvals are still what is recognized by China. And up until about December of last year, that process was working and in place. And then this year in 2023, we hadn't seen any plant list updates. The good news is China did update the establishment lists, and that update included 12 pork establishments and 18 beef establishments. And it was a big sigh of relief that China was still recognizing the Phase One agreement and updating the list as put forward by FSIS. And we still expect to see further updates, hopefully still yet before the end of 2023.
While the China market is not as red hot as in years past, Bohr explains it's still a critical destination for the U.S. pork and beef industries.
There is plenty of pork in the China market, and that's kind of weighing overall. But we still see China helping to support a record year for U.S. pork variety meat exports. Our pork variety meat shipments to China this year are up 9% from last year. Shipments to China of beef so far this year are down 23%, but that still puts them as number four after Korea, Japan, and Mexico. So a huge destination for U.S. beef, and again, one that can turn quickly.
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. In other news, the future of America's dairy farming is bright as global growth and American production capacity and innovation combine to create a powerhouse. Greg Dow, the incoming president and CEO of the National Milk Producers Federation, said in terms of the protein world, dairy is a huge part of the future. As a former chief ag negotiator for the U.S. Trade of Representatives, I can tell you the opportunities are there for U.S. dairies taking with robust outreach and appeals to the world's consumers. Dow made those remarks during the recent NMPF annual meeting that was held in Orlando, Florida. Now, forecasts during a panel discussion at that event showed an improving price look for next year, even as inflation continues to be a challenge for consumers. Learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Brian German.
The Specialty Crops Reporting on Opportunities and Promotion Act, known simply as the Specialty Crop Act, has been introduced to address challenges faced by U.S. specialty crop exporters, such as high tariffs and restrictive trade barriers. The legislation aims to enhance the annual U.S. Specialty Crops Trade Issues Report by explicitly involving the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. It will identify specific trade barriers in target markets and asserts their status under U.S. free trade agreements. The legislation mandates the inclusion of details on U.S. government actions to address barriers, solicits public and agricultural trade advisory committee input, and requires public disclosure while allowing for a classified annex to safeguard national security and economic strategy. The bill defines specialty crop broadly, encompassing fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, dried fruits, and horticultural products. 2023 has been a successful year for agricultural trade relations with Japan. U.S. Trade Representative's Office Chief Ag Negotiator Doug McCaleb detailed one of several accomplishments made in the Japanese market this year.
In January, an updated agreement between the United States and Japan also entered force, revising Japan's beef safeguard mechanism. The updated agreement will allow U.S. beef exporters to more reliably meet Japan's growing demand for high-quality U.S. beef, providing more predictability by reducing the likelihood of safeguard duties being imposed on our beef. Wrapping up these negotiations successfully enabled us to secure continued growing access to our second largest beef export market. Exports of U.S. beef to Japan totaled over $2.3 billion in 2022.
Multiple projects are showing that hydrogel technology can be an effective approach for managing ants.
UC Cooperative Extension Entomology and Pest Management Advisor David Havlin said the hydrogels have been evaluated in a variety of different crops.
There's been work done out in the Channel Islands, out in the national parks, where they were able to use hydrogels with, you know, sugar water in these baits to eradicate Argentine ant successfully. But there's been work by Monica Cooper up in the North Coast in wine grapes, where they've had some success. Mark Hoddle and his team with University of California, Riverside, have done very well in citrus. Our grant, likewise, has been working in citrus and grapes, both in the coast and in the valley. So multiple researchers, multiple ant species, multiple crops, multiple parts of the states that are all coming to similar conclusions that this is a very effective technology. We're honing in on the details of concentrations, rates to apply, and those kind of details.
A virtual workshop series from UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is underway. The series focuses on nitrogen planning and management in organic production of annual crops. Session 2 of the series is scheduled for December 4th, beginning at 1 in the afternoon. This session will focus on estimating nitrogen released from compost, organic fertilizers, and cover crops. Session 3 of the virtual series is scheduled for December 11th. That session will address specific aspects of organic soil fertility management in vegetables. Discussions will include nitrogen in irrigation water, managing water for nitrogen optimization, as well as using and interpreting soil testing. The final part of the series will be an open house grower panel on December 18th, where 1 to 2 growers will share their experience managing nitrogen on their farms. More information about the virtual series is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
A holiday tradition displayed at the nation's capital. Rod Bain has more coming up on This Land of Ours.
The culmination of a busy Tuesday for U.S. Forest Service Chief Randy Moore.
For 53 years, 43 different national forests have had the privilege of providing the people's tree, with a few forests having the honor to provide multiple times.
At West Virginia Elementary School student Ethan Reese.
I live very close to where the Capitol Christmas tree is from, the Monongahela National Forest. I spend a lot of time there with my family, and I'm the great-great-grandson of one of the very first supervisors of the Monongahela National Forest.
Both participated in the holiday tree lighting ceremony at USDA headquarters earlier in the day.
In 1970, when this tradition started, it was the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia that provided the first people's tree. It was a 40-foot Norwood spruce. 6 years later, the Monongahela provided a 41-foot red spruce.
A lot of preparation and effort goes into finding the perfect Christmas tree for the U.S. Capitol. And I'm delighted to say that we made a beautiful selection this year, a 63-foot Norway spruce from the Monongahela National Forest in the Allegheny Mountains of West Virginia. The tree is from Greenbrier Ranger District, home of the very first Capitol Christmas tree provided by the United States Forest Service in 1970. I'd like to thank the Forest Service for finding and providing the People's Tree over these many years. The tree is nicknamed Waltham Tekwi, which means bright tree in the Shawnee language. The tree will glow with thousands of LED lights and sparkle with handcrafted ornaments from the Shawnee tribe and communities across West Virginia.
And later in the evening, took part in the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree lighting ceremony on the Capitol grounds. Reese served as the tree lighter for both events as winner of this year's U.S. Capitol Christmas tree essay contest. The Capitol Christmas tree remains lit, decorated, and on display throughout the holiday season. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news.
We track 48 major commodities each day at the Bottom Line Report, including grain, livestock, but also energies, precious metals, financials. For the month of November, now ended, most agricultural commodities ended lower. Corn, wheat, oats, cotton, live cattle, feeder cattle, and lean hogs all down anywhere from 3 to 13%. Soybeans, meal, and soy oil all managed 1 to 2% gains during the month of November. At the very top of the list, the NASDAQ 100 up 12.75. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Want to prevent holiday weight gain? One expert has an unusual way to do that. Gary Crawford has more.
Well, we got through Thanksgiving, the first major holiday celebration, and did we eat? I would imagine we overdid it, but look out.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Thanksgiving's just the first of several holiday celebrations to come, and as we know,
all of our celebrations contain
a lot of focus on various types of food.
Oh, they do. And Kansas State University Extension consumer science expert Sherilyn Jackson says those foods are generally of the high-fat, high-calorie variety. Not always, though. But they are so good. And many of us will plow into that food. Eating faster and faster, eating like we were condemned or something. And you may have experienced the unpleasant results of that this past Thanksgiving.
What a friend of mine calls this the enjoyment curve. We eat for enjoyment as well as the nourishment. And so maybe the Thanksgiving meal is a good example about how you eat and you're really enjoying the food and you think, wow, that tasted really, really good. So you go back and you get some seconds on things. And then you get to the point where you just feel miserable.
Yeah, we hit the top of the enjoyment curve, fine, but didn't notice the little warning signs of trouble ahead, and suddenly we're rapidly about to run off the road, and enjoyment turns to something else. We don't pay attention to the fact that we're not enjoying the food as we keep packing it in. We don't hear the voice in our subconscious saying, please,
somebody stop me.
We're actually feeling bad, bloated, overloaded. Took too long for the brain to get the message from the stomach that it was full, very full, too full. But Sherilyn says there are ways to avoid that crash off the enjoyment curve. Some people call it mindful eating.
People in Japan call it harahachibu, and this is a Japanese principle where they only eat until they're 80% full. It's a mantra that they say before they eat, to prepare themselves to not eat past that point, to eat only until they're about 80% full. Scientists believe that's a real powerful way that they're able to maintain a healthy weight on average for most of their lives.
Now, wait a minute. Sherilyn, how do they know that they've hit 80%? Well, they got a gauge on their stomach, something to check that out? No, I'm serious.
I think that a lot of it's just paying attention to how you feel and not eating so fast.
Sherilyn says this may help keep us from gaining weight over the holidays too. If we just slow down, not try to eat like it's fast food, instead say,
I want the slow food.
Slow down and have some.
Slow food.
Slow food, yeah. And eat it slowly. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
What are some cons and scams consumers should watch out for as they shop or provide charity this holiday season? Rod Bain reports.
In this holiday season, perhaps you are racing around the clock to get some online deals for holiday gifts, or perhaps feeling charitable and helping those in need. Yet as Amy Knopfsinger of the American Association of Retired Persons is quick to point out, it is also the time of year that various scams are on the rise.
Most importantly during the holiday season is that we're under a little bit more stress than we normally are, and criminals know that. So that's how they're going to try to separate you from your money.
And in the case of scammers, they will tug at your heartstrings and emotions in a quick-paced manner so you can share your personal information or open your wallet. Knopfsinger says the best way to counter such potential scams from impacting you is,
take a breath, stop, slow down when anybody is asking for personal information or financial information.
Now, social media and other sites may offer cost-attractive holiday gifts for purchase during this season, especially to consumers who may have economic challenges this year.
Might click on the link, take them to a site that really isn't that site, put in your credit card number or Venmo number, and then next thing you know, you don't get your item and your money is gone. So just do your research, slow down, and maybe even ask a friend about the opportunity that's coming your way just to get a second opinion.
When it comes to potential online tools consumers can use to research potential businesses and determine their legitimacy,
one of the best things I think to do is take the name of the company that you want to purchase from or do business with, put it in a new search engine, and after that, type in the words complaint, fraud, scam, and see what other people are doing or reporting about that. One thing we know about the internet, people love to share their bad experiences, so use other people's experiences to help your own. But certainly, check with the Better Business Bureau. Call and ask somebody else the opinion before you go and do it.
Imposter scams have also become more frequent in recent years. and as Knopfsinger points out, is another way scammers could perhaps use online shopping habits as a means to fraudulently obtain your money.
Whether that's someone pretending to be from Amazon or eBay, PayPal, saying there's a problem with your account, maybe your Amazon account. Bottom line is they're asking for personal information or to send them a prepaid gift card or go to a crypto ATM machine.
And yes, Knopfsinger says there is such a thing as crypto ATM machines. Over 90,000 nationwide in businesses such as gas stations, smoke shops, and grocery stores.
Someone goes to one of these machines. They apparently have a legitimate purpose. Criminal directs the victim to go to one of these machines, deposit their money, and then that sends the money to the criminal's crypto wallet. It is virtually untraceable and unretractable. The thing is, so many people do not know about these machines, and they don't know that they're selling crypto. They just think they're going to a regular cash ATM machine and depositing it like a bank.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's interview segment with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Today's segment features a conversation between Associate Director of Agricultural Research for the Almond Board, Sebastian Saw, and ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications, Taylor Hillman.
Sebastian, we're gearing up for the Almond Conference. You had a big part with your R&I team as well in putting together these breakout sessions that we have at conference. And there's a little bit of an overall theme here this year because we realize that this is a tough time in the industry, right?
Yeah, Taylor. You know, even though we are crossing very difficult times in our industry, I have to admit I'm quite excited with the content that we have prepared for our conference. I have the opportunity to talk with a lot of our researchers and the different speakers that we have laid out. And I think they have a lot of practical advices on how to reduce input cost and increase efficiency, and rooted in the years of research that we have funded for over the decades or so. So I think we're going to learn a lot of how to cross together these very difficult times. So I'm excited for that.
Let's talk about the sessions that you are moderating, you put together, the first being on Wednesday. Again, the Almond Conference is December 5th through the 7th. Wednesday is the main middle day, which is December 6th. On Wednesday, you have a session about orchard practices. What's this one about?
In this session, we're going to talk about how to optimize critical orchard practices, like the research that is ongoing to avoid pruning, how growers, actually there are good news there, how you could save some money if you are pruning or not, how to increase the fertigation efficiency. So we're going to discuss about our latest learnings in continuous spoon feeding versus episodic fertigation, and how to fine-tune orchard configuration. So a lot of new knowledge that at the end of the day, again, is going to help you to reduce input cost and increase efficiency.
On that panel, you have a lot of people up there that growers are going to be familiar with. Who you have up there on your panel?
So Roger Duncan and Professor Brian Belli from the University of California, and Roger from the University of California A&R system, as well as Franz Niederholzer, Patrick Brown, Thomas Harter, people that have been together with us doing research and extending those results have joined this session to again provide practical tips during these difficult times.
Okay, again, that is on Wednesday, December 6th from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. in Ballroom A9. Growers or industry members who are going to TAC can actually go and see the information now online. The conference program is officially available at almonds.com/conference. Now, you have a second session that you are moderating on Thursday, and this one is about management practices, right?
On Thursday, adaptive management practices in challenging times. We're going to be exploring the pros and cons of things that have worked and may not have worked very well this year. So this session is actually more like a panel that's set up, where I have invited medium-sized growers like Gary Bowman, as well as Brandon Ribeiro from Gold Leaf, and Franz Niederholzer, in this case, Franz again showing up here. He provides a farm advisors overview. So I align So speakers from different angles to talk about the things that work or the things that they have stopped doing or done differently as part of their management times during this difficult time. So Gary's going to talk a lot about irrigation and nutrient management. So Brandon is, again, Brandon is also a board of director from our industry and the co-owner of Gold Leaf. So a lot of experience in pest management as well. So he's going to talk about insect and diseases and weed management. What have he stopped doing it or done differently even these times? And Franz, he's going to talk about harvest, spray coverage, nutrients. So at the end of the day, hopefully with this panel, we have a very insightful discussion that starts with some prep questions to these panelists, but then opens to the participants to ask their questions and discuss, have an open conversation, how we can do these things differently or how things change given the current prices.
Yeah, that was going to be my next statement here, is that this really is going to be an opportunity where people who attend the session can get involved, ask questions. That's what this is about. This is more of a discussion base to talk about how people are managing during these times, right?
Correct. Yes, it's a discussion base. And I think I put on the table panelists that can look at this from different angles and then open it to the whole, to the multiple angles and multiple layers that this have with the participation of the audience.
You have another one on Thursday as well, replanting, right? We're talking about when looking at replanting an almond orchard in today's kind of realm of what's going on, right?
Yeah, I think that's the key. You know, it's in today's financially challenging world. You may have heard before about whole orchard recycling and how to plant a tree, like a 101 on how to plant trees. But maybe with this, the layer that we're adding here with Brent Halls, who has worked a lot, you see a farm advisor expert in this area, is how to discuss these practices in today's financially challenging world. So recycling versus not recycling is going to be part of the discussion, how incentives can help there. Then there's going to have, how do you develop an orchard in today's world from an infrastructure point of view? So do you do soil mapping? Do you adjust your row width, your irrigation system, your pumping, your filtration? We have a line, Matt Cox, he's from Capay Farms. He had a lot of experience in this area, from especially in the Sac Valley. So from a Sac point of view, Valley kind of thing, in terms of new developments and redevelopment. So a lot to talk there. And then we have also jumped with Greg Brown from USDA and Roger Duncan to talk about alternatives to soil fumigation. You know, do I fumigate with today's financially challenging world? Do I actually use cultural practices that may help me because maybe Telon is too expensive? Do I use different rootstocks that may help me to actually print more horsepower into those trees? And those are the things that Greg and Roy are going to come with. I asked them to present ROI analysis, ROI tables, what they may avoid by selecting the right rootstock. So again, really, really oriented to maybe topics that you have always heard, but in this year, in under the context of financially challenging world. So looking forward to see everybody in this session. It's the last one of the conference, so stay together.
Again, the Almond Conference this year is December 5th through the 7th. You can find out all the information you need at almonds.com/conference. Sebastian, anything else you want to mention to anybody listening before we see them in December?
That I really look forward to see them all. Again, I think I sympathize with everybody. I struggle with the current cycle of the business, but at the same time, I'm optimistic that we have good content. We're rooted in research and we have collaborated with the research community and with great farm advisors and growers to overcome together these challenges. So I really look forward to share what we know in December.
Sebastian Saw, Associate Director of Agriculture Research at the Almond Board of California. Sebastian, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour, and now for more of our top stories. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at the potential impacts a storm system coming in from the Gulf Coast this week will have on soils, pastures, and waterways important to agriculture in the Southeast and other areas.
These are areas that have been quite dry through much of the autumn. This rain will not only replenish soil moisture, but it will also help pastures that have really been burned up by the hot, dry weather of the summer and early autumn. And this rain is finally going to start moistening up soils enough that we may start getting some runoff. And that could help with the low river levels that have plagued the Ohio and the Mississippi Basin for several weeks here in this autumn season, and occasionally has caused some disruptions to barge traffic on the nation's busiest inland waterway. Very important for not only shipping grains and oilseeds southward, but moving products, including fertilizer, northward into the Midwest.
In other news, Canada's win against the U.S. in a long-running dairy quota dispute under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement has prompted one senator to call for a retaliation. Opening Canada's restrictive dairy market to more U.S. products was a key reason for negotiating USMCA. But now that the U.S. has lost its fight over Canada's tariff rate quota system that it claims unfairly favors Canadian producers, Senator Chuck Grassley was asked if USMCA is worth the paper it's written on.
Yes, but it depends on whether the administration is willing to take counteraction against some product coming from Canada to show our dislike for it, and I don't know if they're willing to do that.
Retaliation could be challenged as well, but Grassley defends it.
This decision is a huge loss for American farmers, and I think we had 89 senators vote for the USMCA, and it was because of its potential to expand dairy market access to Canada. And it's disappointing the Biden administration could not do more during the dispute panel to show how these quotas harm our farmers and in violation of the USMCA.
At the American Farm Bureau, Senior Director of Government Affairs Dave Salmonson is not ready to give up on USMCA.
The plus side is we have continued mostly tariff-free trade, and that trade continues on a daily basis. So that's the big plus. But along with trade, you get trade problems. And we've got this problem with dairy.
Salmonson says that USMCA has a built-in review mechanism that calls for a refresh in 2026 when he expects the U.S. dairy industry to again raise the Canadian quota issue. In the meantime, USMCA panel could rule late next year on the U.S. case against Mexico's decree against GMO yellow corn, which Salmonson says was put off while Mexico looks for alternatives. An economic research service shows the full impact of African swine fever in China, and that impact was likely more than Chinese officials reported. The agency's report investigated how China's reduced pork supplies affected other pork-exporting countries. The virus moved from Europe to China and spread rapidly throughout the country, leading to a 30-month cycle of decline and recovery. China lost an estimated 27.9 million metric tons of its pork production during that 30-month cycle. Pork prices in China more than doubled, with most of the increase occurring about a year after the initial outbreaks. A total of 31 countries saw surging pork exports to China during that down cycle. Impacts on pork markets outside of China were relatively modest. Increases in pork prices in leading exporters like the U.S., Germany, and Spain were relatively brief and much smaller than the price increases in China. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.